that fratricide is ecocide. And ecocide is fratricide. We'll take a look at that. There are surprises in those texts. If I would connect one more thing that connects yesterday and today with the Bible study this morning, and if you want to look at your Bible, that's Genesis 1:24. Just to point out that it says, and this is in keeping with Marty's Bible study, that creation unfolds in response to an invitation from God. Let there be light. It's not a command, be light. Let there be light. And it says in 1:24, let the soil, earth with a small e, not capital E, that's the planet. Let the soil bring forth. It's an invitation plus the agency of soil that is the creative agent. Topsoil is an agent of creation. It produces life and it provides the provisions for the continuation of life. Hi, Dorothy. So you have let the soil bring forth life. One agent of creation is clay. Now, there is a command here. There are commands. But the first commandment in the Bible comes before there is a single human being around to hear it. Now, why would God be giving commands if there aren't any human beings? Well, it's because God is creator, and it's the whole creation that responds. So get out of your mind that the first covenant is with human beings. It's not, nor is the first command. The first command before any human beings are around is be fruitful and multiply. To whom is that command given?
The sea creatures and the
birds. Yeah, fish and the birds. They get the command to be fruitful and to multiply. So there are still some surprises in this text. Genesis 1:20, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures. Water is an agent of creation. It's water that's bringing forth the swarms as of living creatures, not just fish. And the text doesn't say not just fish. The text goes on to say that it's more than fish. So there are still some surprises. Another one that caught my surprise this morning was that human beings don't get a separate day in creation. Their day is the day of the animals. It's the same day because they're part of them and they're all created from the same stuff. And that stuff is topsoil. So they belong with the rest of the animals who are their companions and their kin. And they receive the same and it was good. As the rest of the animals, and they received the same breath of God that all the creatures received. So there are a few surprises here, and they continue if we take a look at soil. Now I want to start out with a report on how topsoil is faring. In 1942, Walter Loudermilk from the U.S. Soil Conservation Service distributed a report that he had done on world soils. It was titled Conquest of the Land Through 7,000 Years. And the report takes the reader to the Fertile Crescent. You know where the Fertile Crescent is, in the Middle East. And that's where agriculture began, on those alluvial plains of Mesopotamia. It was, to recall the biblical image, a land of milk and honey. Or if one consults the earliest piece of all recorded literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, you have this description of that land. Gilgamesh is a king who reigned sometime between 2700 and 2500 BCE, and his friend Enkidu dies, and Gilgamesh sings sorrowfully of the land. May the bear, the hyena, the panther, the tiger, the leopard, the lion, the oxen, the deer, the ibex, and all the wild creatures of the plain weep for you. May your tracks in the cedar forest weep for you unceasingly, both night and day. May the Ula River, along whose banks we used to walk, weep for you. May the pure Euphrates, where we used to draw water for our water skins, weep for you. That was the Fertile Crescent. The presence of megafauna, a large forest, the Euphrates running clear, is reminiscent of reports by European tribes arriving in the New World. The Passaic River, flowing through what is now Newark, New Jersey, is described as so thick with silvery Atlantic salmon that the people scoop up the salmon from the shore. Now the Passaic hosts some of the largest toxic waste sites in the United States, that same strip. They're fenced in and they're under lock and key because health dangers await any trespassers. This is right next to Newark Airport, incidentally. But Loudermilk's concern was the soils of the Middle East, and his team studied the terrain of Lebanon, the Sinai Peninsula, the famous ruins of Petra, Jordan, Syria, Cyprus, and North Africa. And everywhere he went, he found similar results. Washed off soils, silted canals, meager flora and fauna, and the ruins of dead cities. Now that the soils are gone, all is gone, he concluded in his report. A later Gilgamesh might well have lamented the passing of the land as well as the passing of his friend. Wes Jackson adds two matters to Loudermilk's report. First, the Phoenicians, Greeks, Carthaginians, and Romans all established distant colonies when their own homelands gave out. They consciously and sometimes brutally imported carrying capacity from elsewhere to substitute for what their own stewardship had destroyed. Second, these traders and colonizers were confident that human technological solutions would carry the day. Their elite would figure something out now that their own soils and those of the colonies were being degraded. And Jackson quotes Cicero, this is Roman Empire, time of Augustine, in what might easily have been modernity's bottom line two millennia later. Quote, by means of our hands, we endeavor to create, as it were, a second world within the world of nature. End of quote. Loudermilk came back to the United States from that trip to make what must have been a shocking announcement. The United States was on the same path as the ancients. He had gathered erosion data from across the country, only to find that soil was actually eroding faster than it was being generated. He warned that the United States government was on the path of a self-destructive agriculture, adding that unlike the earlier solutions of Europeans and other empires, there weren't any new continents now available. An update of Loudermilk, his is 1942, confirms this self-destructive course, except that now it holds for the planet as a whole. Nearly 40% of the soils of the world are now seriously degraded. And this is Jackson's report. Globally, nearly one-third of the land devoted to farming has been lost to erosion since 1960 and continues to be lost at a rate of some 25 million acres a year. Now, if Wes Jackson is right, that the ecosphere, biotic and abiotic world together, is the only truly creative planetary force. And if Aldo Leopold is right, that health is the capacity of the land to renew itself, and if René Dubos is correct about malediction falling with certainty upon those who rob the soil of its fertility, Karl Marx said that as well, then we best look anew at humans and humus. Change more profound than a better fertilizer or genetic modification or another large find of potash is required. So we better look at something else. Incidentally, in most places, it changes from place to place. But in most places, it takes about 500 years to generate an inch of topsoil, and we're losing that in decades now. The metabolism rate is way out of kilter. The human economy's metabolism rate is running much, much faster than the metabolism rate of the economy of nature, upon which the human economy totally, utterly depends. You can't have that kind of metabolism drift and have it go on too long. It's unsustainable. So that's the problem that we've got, and we see it in topsoil. Okay, now let me say that if this is a condition that bears paying attention to, it might be worth looking at ancient texts where the notion of the human is inextricably tied to the notion of soil. Let's just read what some folks thought about who we are as human beings. And this goes across most all religions. I'm going to pick on Judaism and Christianity because it's the one, the two we know best. And you know some of this already, and we'll pick it up from there. In the Genesis account, Ha-Adam, and at this point in the first creation story, Ha-Adam is not male. Ha-Adam doesn't have sex. This is gender. This is Ha-Adam as groundling or mud person or earth creature, because Ha-Adam is created from Adamah. I love that picture you had this morning, Marty, of God creating, trying to wrest Adam from the soil, finding it difficult to do so, and the snakes were trying to hold him to it. So earth creature, human earth creature, emerges as a creature of topsoil in the Hebrew. It's usually translated as topsoil. Some translations have red clay. Some of them have humus. But as we noted earlier, let the soil bring forth living creatures. Adama is this living soil that is an agent of creation at God's invitation. Adama is this, because we emerge as earthlings, groundlings, topsoil creatures. Our vocation is to be Shomrai Adama, soil guardians. I put the Hebrew up there. Earth custodians, cultivators who till and keep and care. You're not human if you're not a gardener or a farmer. In this notion, this way of looking at things. To till and keep, Genesis 2:15, is literally to serve and preserve. Or in Psalm 104, to renew the face of the earth. That's why we're here. You emerge from topsoil, live a little while on it to cultivate it, renew it, keep it going, let it keep going, and then you return to it. This Hebrew, Mugdal Ol Shamra, is this to preserve and serve and preserve, which is a Hebrew synonym for cultivate. And who in due course is earth creature's companion? And then you get this radical surgery and you get Isha Nishtah, male and female. And at that point you have Adam, and it's always confusing to us because he kept the same name, but now he's male. Before it wasn't any. Either. Or both. Whatever. the companion is Hava. Eve, which simply means living. It can mean progenitor of life, bearer of life, carrier of life. So if you stay with the mythic character of the language, remember we're not talking about, this is prehistory, we're talking about reflections on origins here. We're not talking about the beginning of history. If you stay with the mythic character here, you've got topsoil guy and bearer of life. That's what who we are and what we're about. the Quran has a wonderful image, I think, for the offspring of Adam and Eve. And you have Adam and Eve in the Quran. It's companions of the garden. Now, the garden is the garden of delights. That's what Eden means. Gan Eden is the garden of delights. So, we are now to be companions of the garden. In the Quran, such companionship carries conditions. Quote, those who believe and work righteousness and humble themselves before their Lord, they will be companions of the garden to dwell there for aid. Let's fast forward here to Luther. Because Luther has this same notion that we are to be cultivators. That's who we are as human beings. God's sublunary habitation is in the sacred soil beneath our souls. for Luther, the finite bears the infinite. Nature's creatures are God's masks. They're the wrappings of God. They're the trappings of God. God's presence fills, I'm reading from Luther, all things, even the tiniest leaf and every little seed. Not only is the divine wholly present in a grain, this is Luther, on a grain, over a grain, Luther finds even the footprints of God in those of a mouse. He says, they have such pretty feet and delicate hair. I mean, they have really nice soles. So all of this is cause for astonishment for Luther. I'm quoting, if you were to search out everything about a kernel of wheat in the field, you would be so amazed that you would die. A seed is a miracle. But Luther finds this, the trappings and wrappings of God. God is present in, with, and under all of the created order. And Luther, now, because he's a good scholar of Hebrew and of Greek, you know, he did the translations. So, he stumbles upon Ha'adam as the farmer. And a creature of Adama, assigned to till and keep the arable loft and topsoil. And remember now that all of Adam's descendants, once you get to this business of, this is now history marching on, Cain, Abel, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are farmers and landholders, tilling the soil and tending the flocks. That should be striking for Jews and for Christians and for Muslims, because that's a very different picture than the surrounding cultures. They're the heroes in Sumeria and Mesopotamia, the archetypal ancestral figures of prehistory are not farmers and shepherds, they're kings and warriors. Now, of course, we may prefer to be a king or a warrior, once we learn from Luther's commentary on Genesis that the cultivator came from a clod. we're all clods. We're a clod of soil. Now, where do good clods go from here? Well, it's no coincidence that the cultivator gives rise to culture and to cultivate. Worship. The same root for cultivation, culture, and worship, cultus. All share that root, and it's the right image, root, because it's in the soil. Culture, agriculture, and the ritual response of marvel and wonder to the miracle beneath our feet. That's the matrix of our life together. Don't be surprised, then, that the breath that gives humans life is the same breath, ruach, that animates other animals and the plants. They've got soul, too. Don't be surprised that all the Jewish holy days had their origins in agricultural festivals. In the Awist's account, the liturgical year is carried out at agricultural centers, Shechem, Hebron, Bethel, Beersheba, at altars built by farmers near sacred oak trees. And the word for God, El, is related to the word for oak, Elam. The ancestral theophanies are invariably associated with an oak tree or a grove, a mountaintop, or a spring of living water. All of the major shared religious symbols are taken from nature. It's the sacred mountain. It's the river of living waters. It's the tree of life. And don't be surprised that there's some tension in this Yahwistic account in which the human is servant of the land, that's in attention with the priestly account, where we're given the command or the invitation to have dominion. And we won't take time now, but it's fascinating to see the prescriptions for altars in Deuteronomy. Because in the priestly account, the altar that is built is one that has the best of human technology at the time. With bronze, I mean, it's inscribed. For in the Yahwistic account, that's forbidden. It can only be topsoil. You can put stones on there, but you mustn't inscribe any of them. That's not who you are. So the tension is already there in the scripture between having dominion and being servant of the land. But my main point, and we'll make one more after this about Cain, and then go to discussion. The main point is that the nexus of cultus, worship, culture, and agriculture, we're the miraculous clods who are cultivators by calling, is nicely captured by Wendell Berry In talking about topsoil, it's hard to avoid the language of religion. And we still sense that, I think, although we're pretty alienated from it. So put aside the superstition of some religions that soul and soil are separate categories. Decent land use is less about economics than about cultivation and the state of our souls, together with the state of soil. How a people treats soil tells you much about their way of life and its soul. That so much agricultural work is regarded as demeaning, fit only for underpaid menial labor on the part of workers accorded little respect, is a direct commentary on the state of that society. Now, I put one more thing up here from Islam, because the central daily ritual of Islam is a call to prayer, 5 times a day. FLH is the root of felah, which is the word for farmer, and felahin, farmers. That root means cultivate. And the call to prayer is Haya al-Filah, Haya al-Selah, said twice. Come to self-cultivation. Islam's most marked daily ritual is a call to cultivate soil and soul together. Because that's who we are. You don't lose anything in translation when you go to English. H-U-M is the root for human, humus, humble, and humility. It's also the root for homo and homo sapiens. So the word good dirt is worth a little humor on our part. So the next time someone asks you, where are you from, consider replying, from 6 inches of topsoil and a little rain. How about you? All right. Okay, now let's jump over to Cain and why Cain is so upset. If you want to have a Bible handy, that would be fine. I'll go back to my opening point first to set the context, namely that we're losing the topsoil from which we come and to which we return and of which we are faster than it's being generated. Even though topsoil has, as an agent of creation, has all the wherewithal to provide the conditions for its ongoing life. You have to work hard against its own powers of creation in order to really be destructive of it and then of yourselves. That's why Genesis always goes forward. We're now running Genesis backward. That's what the essence of unsustainability is. Now, are there any clue in these ancient texts to the way in which we have gone astray? And I will argue here that the cultivators and their technologies have become alienated from their origins in Adama. And when these alienated humans muster enough power to try and control nature and destiny, then the cultivators violate creation's integrity. It has its own integrity. That is, it's an integral functioning of life systems. Choosing the tree of knowledge over the tree of life, instead of taking our measure from the tree of life and placing knowledge in service of it, boomerangs. And the result is a rude and a crude justice that disciplines human hubris, another one of those hum words, human hubris, disciplines human ignorance and hubris by foiling our efforts to control life on our terms. To eat from the tree of knowledge as the source of power, rather than feasting in gratitude on the tree of life and placing our knowledge in subservience to life, is to fall from grace. The first recorded violation of creation's integrity is the killing of Abel by Cain. Be prepared for some more surprises. The death is where? Genesis 4:8. Where does it happen?
In the field.
In the field. At the hands of whom? How is Cain described? Genesis 4:2. The tiller of Adamah. So the death happens at the hands of a tiller of Adamah in the field. Who cries out? Now when Abel is killed, Abel, incidentally, this is strange, but in Hebrew it's H-E-V-E-L, and it means a wisp, nothingness, meaninglessness. Now, when Cain kills Abel, who cries? Who do you think would cry out?
Adam and Eve.
Yeah, of course. The folks, my goodness. One son kills the other son. Where in the text do you read that Adam and Eve cry out? All right, then tell me who does. Look at Genesis 4:10. No? No? Not God?
The ground.
Yeah. It's Adamah. It's the soil. Not God, not Adam, not Eve. I assume they all cried out, but that's not in the text. The text says it's Adamah. What sense does that make that the ground cries out? I'm not sure we're capable of understanding how deep our alienation from soil is, that we don't really even feel the ground crying out when it does cry out, even though that's who we are, cultivators. Adamah, the source of ongoing life that is to be watered by the, nurtured by the waters of life, is violated by receiving human blood instead, the result of human violence. The consequence of this primal bloodletting is that the ground, what? Genesis 4:12.
Shall no longer yield its strength.
Yeah. The ground will no longer yield to you its strength. The ground itself is cursed because of you. You violated yourself, who you are as a species, and you and you violated that from which you have come. Fratricide is ecocide. The ground will not yield its strength when injustice is done one to another. There is such a tie of human being and human well-being to the well-being of the soil. Fratricide is ecocide and ecocide is fratricide. You cannot serve injustice to human beings without having consequences for the rest of the community of life. The destruction of the community of life or parts of it will have consequences for human well-being. Planetary health is primary. human well-being is derivative. So Cain's response, what do you think his response is going to be to this violation of Adamah? Someone want to read this from Genesis 4:14? He's talking to God now. Isn't it 4:14 then? Somebody read 4:14 and see if I've got the right verse here.
Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from thy face shall I be hid, and I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth. And it shall come to pass that everyone that findeth me shall slay me.
Yeah. Okay, I have a slightly different translation. Today you have driven me from the soil, Cain says to God in agony. And I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on earth. This is more punishment than Cain can bear, to be alienated from the soil. Because that's who he is. As a human being, he's a tiller who is here to serve and keep the earth, small e. So Cain, alienated from his origins in fertile soil and his vocation as a human tiller, is homeless on earth. And what else? He's estranged from God. God's face is hidden to him because God came to him by way of the soil and the rest of creation. Banished from the Garden of Delight, Gan Eden, he settles in the land of Nod, Genesis 4:16. Do any of you have a note about what Nod means? It's a strange place to settle.
Wandering.
Yeah. There's no settling there.
There's no there.
It's only wandering. You're homeless. You're alienated from the soil, so you are homeless. And with this primordial divorce from the soil, even God's face is hidden. Which is to say, if and when nature is lost to our senses, God is as well. We do not know God's presence and power apart from our senses. God, however, and this is in some sense the theology of the cross and of grace, God, however, doesn't abandon Cain. Cain cries, I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on earth, and anyone who meets me, you read it, may kill me. I mean, he's worried that what's going to happen to him is what he did to Abel. The all-compassionate and merciful one then marks Cain so that he does not suffer the same death that he inflicted upon Abel. Here is the first case of mercy exceeding justice. And renewed life, albeit in diminished terms, is offered. Okay, then I'll just finish with this. This alienation from soil and therefore from God, and the resultant curse whereby the ground does not yield its strength, does not continue with its powers as it does when it is properly kept, is accompanied by one last dimension. It's the ethical. Cain, that tiller of the ground, answers God's question of Abel's whereabouts with his own question. And you know this question. I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? Cain's is a denial posed as a question. It means, I am not my brother's keeper. Mm-hmm. Who is my brother to me? Cain actually never calls Abel his brother until God names Abel Cain's brother. And then he can only turn it back as so as to deny or to refuse that tie. That may be the reason why Abel in Hebrew means a vapor or meaninglessness or nothingness. It just doesn't register with Cain. So that's why the Blake picture isn't exactly right. Because the Blank picture has Cain in horror at the killing of his brother. There's nothing in this text that indicates Cain has any remorse about killing his brother or recognizing who his brother is. Cain's horror is his alienation from the soil, being banished from that which he is himself as a tiller. Not being able to be human. That's his horror. Okay. To be the tiller is to be the keeper as well. There's a nice piece in Robert Pope Harrison on gardens that I just want to share as a way of finishing this. Harrison asks, why is mountaintop removal wrong? Stripping the mountains in Appalachia for the coal. I love his answer here. Why is mountaintop removal and an economy of pure extraction wrong? Because it has nothing to do with the humility, devotion, and curatorial vocation of the gardener. It's wrong because, as gardeners by nature, we're companions of the garden. That answer comes from somewhere outside the industrial paradigm, outside of our way of life. The gardener's way of relating to the rest of nature is alien even to agribusiness. Agribusiness doesn't know about gardening. Sell you some seeds and some Roundup, but it doesn't know the values, the character, the virtues of the gardener. the gardener's way of relating to the rest of nature is alien even to agribusiness, but consider it in view of mountaintop removal as modern industrial technology par excellence vis-a-vis soil. In agribusiness, you don't even try to enrich the soils. You feed the plants. That's very different to directly affect the growth of the plants rather than by feeding them particular nutrients, rather than enriching the soil and keeping, tilling and keeping the soil. and this is Harrison, when it comes to the soil, that is, the entirety of the natural resources locked away in the earth, the drive of modern technology is to extract, remove, and deplete, rather than cultivate, enhance, and foster. Those are hard words. To cultivate, enhance, and foster is the gardener's calling. By contrast, Harrison says, scalping the mountains removes far more than it gives back. It tills violently, but it does not keep. And that's pretty much the summary of what we're doing collectively to topsoils around the world. We're tilling without keeping. It visits like a malediction and leaves the ground cursed without true repair, much less enhancement. Then the fertile soil, the fertile crescent anywhere, gets rendered infertile. Now it can be otherwise, might be otherwise, but it's going to take a change in our way of life. Okay, how might we be cultivators? How might we rediscover the human vocation? If these texts have anything to say, you can take issue with the texts too. But I just wanted to try to read ancient texts vis-a-vis how topsoil is faring today and see if there's any insight that comes there. Are there insights for you, or do you have some suggestions about how we recapture being good clods instead of bad clods, Nancy?
I'm missing both of my Norwegian grandfathers. One was a true gardener. He lived in town, but everything went back in the soil and had the best garden in town. And the other grandfather was a very sweet man who would go with the flow on everything except his soil. And it was my great-grandfather's 40 acres that nourished his 10 siblings. It's, you know, this was... He was of that soil, and he was born on that farm, and passed that down to my mother and her uncle. And I remember seeing him in arguments where it was like life or death arguments. I think, who is this man? This sweet, kind man. And he'd be so angry at his neighbors for planting corn year after year after year, and some of the fertilizing that they did. But it's encouraging to see young people moving up to small.
There's a whole movement. The New Agrarians is precisely that. And one of the real pieces of gospel, of real good news, is that these small farms tended like that actually produce more than we can produce by way of agribusiness. The production per acre is greater there in this kind of mixed farming. Besides that, the animals and the plants have a life themselves. And the chickens aren't in cages 5x7. 90% of the eggs that you get are produced by chickens in cages 5x7. Those chickens on those farms are alive. Yeah.
We are in the process, in fact, this week of getting rid of our backyard and having much less grass and a lot of native kinds of plants that don't require much water.
Uh-huh.
And the folks who are working on it, we're going to do this thing called sheet mulching.
Yeah.
But the whole thing that it does is it encourages vertical worms and horizontal worms. I mean, this guy is a worm scientist, so it protects and enhances the soil even as we start having less grass.
Yeah,
you know,
you're working on soil. You're working on soil.
Yeah, that's what.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of interesting to hear this.
Yes.
But he was home.
Yeah.
Sheet
mulching.
It takes care of all the weeds that are just, you know, we have lots of Bermuda grass, but it does it in such a way that it builds the soil and you're not using herbicides.
Yeah. Yeah. Please.
I was going to say that Michael Pollan's books are wonderful, and I suspect many in here have read them, The Omnivore Dilemma.
Yeah.
But his more recent book basically says, eat food that your grandparents would recognize you eating food. That's a good one to think about, you know.
Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. That's his rule there. And in The Omnivore's Dilemma, the person who comes across as kind of the best in this natural history of four meals is Joel Salatin at Polyface Farm, doing something of the same thing that you're doing, who calls himself a Christian libertarian environmentalist. But anyway, Joel Salatin has no good word for the big organic farms that use fossil fuels to run the machinery to produce pesticide and herbicide-free lettuce. He thinks that doesn't get outside the industrial paradigm that we need to do. And Polyface Farm works is a kind of permaculture where everything complements everything else, and you build up soil and the life of the animals and so on. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Omnivore's Dilemma is a great book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot of very good things going on now, both in terms of what people are doing and how they're describing it. Some of the great literature now is being written by farmers. I mean, we know some of them, Wendell Berry and so on, but there's a lot of just plain farmers who are, yeah, they got a little bit of time in the wintertime, just beautiful expressions.
For those of us who aren't farming, another thing that's helpful is to support farming.
Sure.
And farmers markets. And I had sort of a little thing where instead of buying organic food because it was good for me,
yeah,
I buy organic food because it's good for the earth.
Good.
The rest of you.
That's very nice.
So,
yeah. That's a whole new criterion for why we should buy food. Is it good for me? Oh, that's an important consideration. Is it good for the other folks? That's important. Is it good for the earth? Is it good for the soil? Is it good for where it's coming from? I've used this too often, but here's another time. I love contrasting how people are human in the supermarket compared with farmers market. If you go into a supermarket and you watch people shop, you hear no conversations. There are no relationships present there except a commodity and the one who's purchasing the commodity. And there's a have a great day when you check out. That's the one human relationship that happens there, even though there are lots of people around. I mean, some of them get in your way, you know? So, and then contrast that dead zone with the buzz at the farmer's market. The conversations are everywhere. And people get to know the farmer. Sometimes they get invited out there, and the kids go out and raid. Ride pony as well.
But when I go to Safeway, the cashier always looks at the receipt so that she can greet me by name.
Yes. Oh, very nice.
You got
something going. You got a deep relationship going. Yeah. Yes. So, and the farmer's market in Santa Fe is wonderful because it's also a very good community citizen. So there's a relationship with there's a movement among the restaurants to buy at the farmer's market, so it's farm to table kind of thing, and working out something so that the high prices aren't getting in the way of other people shopping. That's the biggest problem, is that you've got a lot of poor people who can't afford to buy at the farmer's market. So we're taking food stamps and other things, trying to break that important class issue. There, but the farmer's market is also opportunities for community-supported agriculture where you buy a subscription and pick up your food and learn to deal with the fact that you've got this week in large quantities.
You've got to figure out what to do with.
Larry. Yeah.
Another obvious word for connecting with soil is compost.
Compost, yeah. Yes.
As you're doing this tonight and thinking in another dimension, I mean, simply besides doing with your food waste,
yeah,
is how humbling it is to realize how little soil you get out of a whole year of garbage.
Yes.
You really don't get very much.
Yeah, but it's really good stuff.
It's good.
It is. I mean, it's really good. When you mix it with that other soil, and you've got something going.
Yeah.
It's also humbling to realize that, you know, on our better days, we're also a compost.
I wanted to push back a little bit on that comment about expense and class.
Yeah.
I've had an intuition for a long time that that's not true.
Oh.
And I've read recently, someone really has taken a look at it, aside from the part about food stamps that have been accepted. But if you're looking at cost of just calories, sure, it's cheaper to go to Safeway and shop the dinner aisles with things in boxes. But if you're looking at the cost of nutrients, it's not but there's a great advantage to agribuilt business to continue that myth. So we need to remind one another. So it's not frivolous and it's not more expensive.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's
a good point.
That's
not full human beings. And I would put cooking there too.
Uh-huh.
Yay.
You know, Mark Bitton has a new short book called Cooking Solves Everything.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem with Lewis for poor as well.
Yeah.
You know, for, in some cases.
Mark Bitton's wonderful on this. Yeah. Food, glorious food.
Yeah. So teaching people to cook, learning to cook,
We got to go now. We just finished a week at Ghost Ranch, which is in New Mexico, and the seminar we had this year was Food, Glorious Food, the Eucharist, and Your Food Shed. Food shed like watershed. Where does your food come from? What does it do there? And I hope that one thing that comes out of these kinds of conversations when we have to look at old texts anew, retrieved traditions, etc., to ask if they're earth-honoring, is that we have a conversation between that which is sacramentally important to us, like water, baptism, and the literal of life. If food is is a sacred meal, what does that have to do with food, the rest of the food that we have? Is there a conversation? Is there a theology of the natural world in the Eucharist that we share? This is the kind of conversation we should be pursuing. Thanks a lot.